this quote. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. I wanted to introduce two clips that I'm playing today. One is the fantastic speech that Ruha Benjamin Spellman, Ruha Benjamin delivered at Spellman College, which is something for the time capsule, really. This is a speech about sisterhood, but also a speech about the troublemakers on campus that she champions, that are the real hope for peace and harmony in this world, and the real anti-war activists. Also, this is a speech about how Black faces in high places are not going to save us, and solidarity with Gaza and Sudan and Haiti. And that'll be followed by an electronic intifada coverage of the retaliation that happened, the Iran retaliation against Israel for the bombing of their embassy in Syria, which is being misinterpreted, or rather misreported by the mass media here, not acknowledging that it's actually a historic moment for Iran in terms of what they did and what they achieved with this retaliation. So let's start with listening to Ruha Benjamin's speech at Spelman College.
President Gale, Board of Trustees, beloved faculty, staff, students, alumni, fellow honorees, and everyone working behind the scenes to gather us in this space, my heartfelt thanks for this special recognition. To my village, my family, my friends, my sisters from other misters, my Baha'i family and aunties, my beloved professor, Dr. Barbara Carter, Sister Amelika, so many more I won't belabor. So what a lovely video introduction. Like most beautifully produced and polished bios and resumes, it necessarily leaves out the messy parts of life, including the fact that when I was a student at Spelman, I was somewhat of a troublemaker. Truth is, I have never quite identified with the idealized image of a Spelman woman. And still today, I'm not what you might call a school spirit girly, which I know is a weird thing to admit given the occasion. For starters, I really struggle to pull together a white outfit because after all these years, it's still not my color. But perhaps more revealing is that the first time I stood at this podium giving the valedictory speech to my class in 2001, I had just given birth a week before. So, not quite the idealized Spelman woman, but that's also what I loved and I love deeply about this place. That precisely by bringing us all together under the umbrella of Black womanhood, we get to experience our many shades of blue as a blues people. Unlike predominantly white institutions where Black students may feel a need to put up a united front to survive the everyday stresses and strains of navigating a hostile environment, here in this place, we have more space to explore the full range of our humanity, if we choose. When we do, we get to appreciate our breathtaking differences and our quirky individuality. Like the way that growing up in South Carolina versus Seattle, Louisiana versus Lagos, shape our experiences and worldviews. And in that, we have so much to share and learn from one another. When we bear witness to our many shades of blue, we necessarily begin to reckon with the way that classism, colorism, ableism, lookism, homophobia, fatphobia, and more create fault lines and hierarchies that complicate the ideal of sisterhood. And that's when our real education begins. After all, we don't come to Spelman just to receive a world-class education. And I should say, this was the only school I applied to. A world-class education in history, sociology, computer science, women's studies. We're also here to study sisterhood. Beyond the feel-good platitudes, we get to truly investigate this thing that is supposed to bind us. What is sisterhood? A feeling, a sense of duty, a shared history. But how do we practice it? Who is welcomed in and who is left out? What makes us a good sister? What do we do when we aren't good? When we hurt each other? How do we forgive and do better? What does it mean, in short, to study sisterhood? One of my favorite lines from Beloved is, "She is a friend of my mind. She gather me, man, the pieces I am. She gather me and give them back to me in all the right order," wrote Morrison. When we look closely at the lives of many of our luminaries, Tony Cade, Audre Lorde, June Jordan, Alice Walker, bell hooks, Toni Morrison, and more, we learn that their work was made possible by the bonds of sisterhood. When we choose to study sisterhood, by which I mean take it seriously, tend to it, learn from it, invest in it, sisterhood holds the promise of gathering us up again and again and again, which is why I'm convinced that sisterhood is not the icing on the cake of our Spelman experience. It's the flour, the water, the leaven. It won't be on our transcripts, but etched into our spirits. And so perhaps this is a good time for me to admit that for many years, I wasn't a good sister. As a young mother in grad school especially, I was so focused on jumping through professional hurdles and hoops and surviving the grueling expectations of academia that sisterhood took a back seat. I wish someone would have reminded me at that time that friendships should never take a back seat. They are the fuel. They are the compass. They are the road of any work worth its salt. This is on my mind right now because I'm reading a book on how a network of Black women changed American culture by Courtney Thorson, which describes how in the late 70s, a group of Black women writers, editors, teachers, students, and journalists met regularly over the course of 2 years in New York City to support, to protect, and advocate for each other. Each of the women, some better known than others, is spectacular in their own right. But as Thorson writes, it was the hard, everyday, largely unseen labor that made that spectacular period possible. as they work to get Black women's writings published, read, reviewed, studied, and taught. Just a few years after this group started gathering, their work flooded the literary landscape. June Jordan's Passion in 1980. Tony Cade Bambara's Salt Eaters, also in 80. Walker's The Color Purple in 82. Shange's Sassafras in 82. Lord's Zami in 1982. Morrison's Tar Baby in 84. Among many other works that grew out of the sisterhood. The point is not simply that the sisterhood made them productive and successful, but that the sisterhood gathered the pieces they were and gave them back in all the right order. As Walker would say in an interview with the late Rudolph Byrd, we thought we must create a space for Black women writers to honor each other, to know each other, so that nothing from outside could make us fight over anything or even feel competitive. This was the sisterhood's purpose, she said. And although they worked mightily to resist competition and ranking, there were, of course, class and generational differences leading to arguments and conflict. As Septima Clark would say in a very different context, don't ever think that everything went right. It didn't. Many times there were failures, but we had to mull over those failures and work until we could get them ironed out. Same with sisterhood. It's not only seven. As you begin your study of sisterhood, I invite you to embrace it all, the sweetness and the bitters. Because the world outside of Spelman gives us very little space or time to savor the complexity of who we are. Above all else, I want to encourage you to be careful with each other, so you can be dangerous together. Graduating class of 2024, as you complete your studies and navigate new workplaces, professions, cities, and experiences, I want to remind you that Spelman is more than a college. It's a flight school, the NASA for Black women, that imparts not only intellectual skills, but the spiritual audacity to fly in and out of worlds that were not created with you in mind. When you feel weighed down, as we all do, I want to encourage you to dust off your wings, sown by generations of Spelman women over the course of 143 friggin' years, so you can fly and be fly. Remember, too, that despite the social media slogan, trust Black women, you too have to be trustworthy. Black faces in high places are not going to save us. Just look at the Black proponents of Cop City in Atlanta's leadership class. Black faces in high places are not going to save us. Just look at the Black woman's hand, ambassador at the UN, voting against a ceasefire in Gaza. That is, our Blackness and our womanness are not in themselves trustworthy. If we allow ourselves to be conscripted into positions of power that maintain the oppressive status quo, our Blackness and womanness are not themselves trustworthy if we support the occupation of Black neighborhoods with so-called better trained police, or remain silent about the genocide of oppressed peoples around the world funded by our tax dollars. And here, let me please shout out the incredible Spelman students and AUC siblings who have been organizing with Stop Cop City and Justice in Palestine, among many other troublemakers in this room. You all remind us that college is not a waiting room to enter the real world, but that you can start transforming that world right here, right now. It goes without saying, but let me just say it anyway. For student activists speaking out courageously for Palestine and Congo and Haiti and to stop Cop City, they should not be threatened with expulsion, loss of scholarships, or have public safety called on them for protesting. Too often, our institutions celebrate student activists after they've graduated. Even giving them honorary degrees. But stifle student activism while we are enrolled. We can do better. To close then, as we turn our attention to the founders of Spelman College who dared to dream beyond the oppressive systems that sought to limit their opportunities, to limit their imagination and crush their spirits 143 years ago. Let's also time travel in the other direction, opening a portal 143 years into the future, to the students and faculty and staff who will gather in Sisters Chapel in the year 2167. We are, after all, their ancestors. So then, what kind of sister ancestors are we going to be? Successful and compliant? Or purposeful and courageous? That is, we are our descendants' wildest dreams. Each of us has the privilege and responsibility of answering that for ourselves honestly and joyously. With that, thank you, thank you, thank you for this incredible honor.
That was Dr. Benjamin at the Spelman College delivering the speech at this year. The theme was Black faces in high places are not going to get us anywhere, that you repeated and called on people to be purposeful and courageous. And I find it really interesting that she said that usually they celebrate activists after they've graduated, but as we've seen on every campus in the DMV area, and especially on American University campus, they're stifling the speech of the same activists, which they will be forced to celebrate later, whether they like it or not. I can't listen to that speech enough. It's just the most succinct and comprehensive speech about identity politics, about real revolutionary change, about sisterhood, and about brotherhood, really. With that, we're going to start the second clip here, which is comes to us from the Electronic Intifada, and this is about the recent retaliation by Iran against Israel, a real assessment of what really happened and the consequences of what happened. Let's have a listen.
All right, he is here. Hello, Professor Mirandi.
Hi.
Hi, Professor Mirandi. And just for those, we've got a lot of people joining the stream, and just for those who are just coming in, we're very happy to welcome you to the Electronic Intifada live stream. You are Dr. Mohammed Mirandi, Professor of English Literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran, and a noted political and, let's say, geopolitical analyst. And we're really delighted to have you on.
Thank you very much. That sounds very important. So I'll keep that.
You are very important and very insightful. So let's get right into it. You're in Tehran. As you may have just heard, and as we just went through in our overview, the U.S. and Israel are trying to downplay this operation. They're claiming to have shot down the vast majority of the missiles. Of course, we did see some of those missiles hitting the ground, but they claim that those caused little damage. And they're just trying to say, no big deal. The fact that we had to mobilize the U.S. Air Force, the British Air Force, and all our allies in the region, all of Israel's assets, but it's no big deal. They're trying to shrug it off. What's your reaction to that from Tehran?
Well, first, I have to apologize because I've been last night till morning, I was doing media. I was up till like 7 a.m. and then I slept three, four hours. And then again, it was media till now. So I really don't know the news as well as I should. I don't know what's going on. And it's been very interesting because, as you point out, the media has been pursuing a very monolithic perspective. They're all saying the same thing, whether it's Al Jazeera or Sky News or BBC. Those that I've been on, they've been saying that nothing happened. This was not a significant event. And all of the drones and missiles were down. What I can say is that there are a number of things are important. I will leave the context for later, why Iran struck. I think your audience knows that. But first of all, the drones and missiles that Iran fired were largely inexpensive drones and old missiles. Those were used in order to draw fire from the Israeli anti-missile systems. So the Iranians literally spent, let's say, a couple of million dollars on the drones and maybe a few million dollars on the missiles. These are very old missiles. And the Israelis, the Americans, the French, and the British, and perhaps the Jordanians, all of them together tried to bring down these missiles and drones. So the Israelis spent, according to one estimate that I saw, $1.3 billion to bring down drones and missiles that were worth $4, $5, $6 million. But those drones were decoys. Those missiles were decoys. That was the intention in the first place. Then there were a limited number of missiles that were those that were seriously being used to target two strategic sites. One was an air base in the south, and if I'm not mistaken, an intelligence gathering facility in the north, which is also linked to the Air Force, if I'm not mistaken. So those missiles got through because, as you rightly pointed out, we've seen them strike. There's footage of missiles striking the ground. So in reality, the Iranians fired a small number of missiles that were targeting, as rightly pointed out, military bases. Iran is not like the Israelis where they just bomb Gaza and massacre women and children. Even though overwhelmingly Israelis support the genocide, according to polls, the Iranians did not target them. They targeted the most well-protected bases that the regime has. And why did they target that base in the south? It was because that base and that intelligence gathering base in the north were both used for the airstrike on the Iranian embassy, and the base in the south, the air base in the south, has been used to bomb Gaza. So from my perspective, in my opinion, this was clearly a success because the Iranians use a very small part of their capabilities to create chaos in Israel. And that, and they've been also been playing mind games with Israelis for over 10 days. In addition to that, and I think what's even more important, is that Iran has changed the equation.
Well, Dr. Marandi, before you get to that, that's an important point. I want to show, I don't think, because of the way we're set up today, I don't think we can actually show the media, but I want to, on this point, this morning there was a statement from Hussein Salami, the general who's in command of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps that carried out the attack, and he said, "We have decided to change the equation." And what he says, his words here, he says, "This equation is that from now on, if Israel attacks Iranian interest figures and citizens anywhere, they will retaliate from Iran." So I'd just like you to react to that and elaborate on that. I think that's where you were going, but I wanted to provide that for context.
Well, actually, to my embarrassment, I haven't seen that because, as I said, I've been doing so much media that I know very little about what's going on. But yes, I think basically what he's saying is that Iran has changed the equation here, in that in the past, the Iranians have shown strategic patience. Both in the recent past, when the Iranians were trying to keep the focus on Gaza, the Israelis attacked Iranian positions and killed a number of Iranians in Syria during the past 6 months. The Iranians, though, did not respond, at least directly. And the reason was because they wanted the focus to be on the genocide and the world to focus on what the Israelis and the Americans and the Europeans are doing to the children and people of Gaza. But also before that, when Iran was in Syria helping in the fight against ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all the other terror groups that NATO and the Israelis and their regional allies were supporting, back then the Israelis were also bombing Iranians and their allies in Syria in order to support ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Because Al-Qaeda and ISIS, they had bases alongside the Golan Heights and they were supported by the Israelis. So I think your audience knows that. It's well documented, so I won't go into it. But back then, the Iranians did not respond because they wanted to keep the focus on Syria. And also, the Syrian government was so weakened by this decade-long dirty war, which is more than has gone on for more than a decade now, that it also didn't want to have more trouble, which was understandable. But also, the Iranians showed strategic patience because they had a long-term project, something that we now know. The infrastructure, the military infrastructure under Gaza, under Lebanon, under Yemen, the underground facilities that these three countries and these three territory areas have, they were created over two decades. And the military capabilities, the training, all that was a very long-term project. So I think the Iranians did not want to derail their long-term project for the resistance through a direct conflict with the Israelis. But this strike was different because it was a direct assault on Iranian territory. It was carried out by F-35s, and six missiles were fired at the building. People were killed. So the Iranians felt that if they did not respond, then the Israelis would basically feel that they can start bombing all of Iran's embassies and they'll get away with it because the U.S., the French, and the British, they supported them. And in the U.N. Security Council, they prevented the council from condemning Israel, let alone punish them. So Iran decided to strike the Israeli regime. Why, though, is this a change in the equation? Because from now on, as you alluded to by reading the statement, from now on, the Iranians are going to hit back at the Israelis whenever they hit Iran. So if the Israelis tomorrow carry out an airstrike in Syria, which targets Iran or Iranian-affiliated groups or positions, then the Iranians will strike back at Israel directly. It won't be like in the past, where the Iranians show strategic patience. And I think that's a very significant change, because that decreases the options of the Israeli regime. Also, what happened last night, because of the drones and the old missiles that I spoke about earlier, that the Iranians sent as decoys, the Israelis have depleted their air defense systems. And Iran has probably more than 100,000 missiles and tens of thousands of drones, if not more, in their different bases. They have underground bases for missiles and drones across the country. And they've been preparing themselves, again, for 20 years, not just for Israeli regime, but mostly for the Americans, in case there's conflict with the United States. And I think the fact that after the drone strikes were carried out, and we heard that the United States did not want to get involved in any escalation with Iran, shows that the United States takes Iran's drone and missile capabilities very seriously. Because if there's escalation, then U.S. bases across the region will be destroyed, they'll be overrun. And those countries that host those bases, they'll be seen as complicit, and they'll be targeted. So the oil and gas production and facilities in the Persian Gulf and the Caucasus will be destroyed, and that will create a catastrophe for the United States.
Dr. Marandi, let me focus in on that a little bit, because we've seen, as you mentioned, a lot of condemnation, not to mention, of course, the role they played directly in trying to thwart the Iranian self-defense operation. But just to give an example, a statement from the German ambassador to Tel Aviv, he said, "Germany's solidarity is with all Israelis tonight, whom Iran is terrorizing with this unprecedented and ruthless attack." That's a very rich statement from someone who has been fully supportive of Israel's campaign of bombing civilians, schools, hospitals, starving them to death, where by contrast, Iran very precisely attacked military targets, and Israel hasn't reported a single civilian injury. In fact, I think they did support one young girl from the Bedouin community who was injured by falling shrapnel. That was the only injury that Israel reported. But the bigger picture here is that the U.S., which of course is the chief of the axis of genocide, let's call it, doesn't seem to want an escalation with Iran. John Kirby, the National Security Council spokesperson for the White House, came out this morning and said, "We're not looking for a bigger confrontation in the region." As you've explained, Iran has not been looking for that because they have a long-term project. So we have some people, I've had some people saying that, well, is that the correct reading? In other words, was this an attempt by Iran to calibrate its response to send a strong message to Israel and its backers, but without escalating things to an open-ended military confrontation?
Yes, Iran is seeking a permanent ceasefire. And during the last 10 days, as Iran was playing mind games with the Israelis, the Iranians were also pushing for concessions and to force the Americans to push for the ceasefire. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. And I think that the Iranians were using this opportunity to as leverage, or these 10 days as leverage to push the ceasefire a ceasefire agreement, a meaningful ceasefire agreement, forward, but again, to no avail. The Iranians don't want to create a regional war, but the Iranians, A, wanted to punish the Israeli regime. B, they wanted to tell the regime that from now on, we have a new situation. If you ever touch an Iranian again, if you ever strike an Iranian again, it doesn't matter if it's an embassy or if it's in Syria or it's in Lebanon, we will hit you back. So that makes things more difficult for the Israelis in future to carry out operations. But also, the Iranians have shown the United States that they're very serious. And that also makes the situation more difficult for the Israelis, because the United States has been revealed to be deeply concerned about escalation. And that limits the maneuverability of the Israeli regime. It limits how much they can maneuver, how much they can use the American card as leverage in the weeks and months ahead. And if the Americans are not going to escalate for the sake of Netanyahu and the Israelis, then they're definitely not going to escalate for anyone else, because they don't care for anyone else nearly as much as this genocidal regime. So I think that's something that people will take note of across the region. Those who bound their fate to the Americans will be looking and saying, wow, the Iranians attacked Israel. And we have an inconsistent narrative. So the Western media is saying nothing happened, but the German ambassador is screaming bloody murder on the other hand. But these people will be looking and saying, well, if the Americans are not going to escalate for the sake of the Israelis, then they're not going to, if we need the Americans, if we push for the Americans to act in our favor, then they're not going to do anything for us either. I think there are lots of implications for what happened last night. And it is detrimental to the interests of both the Israeli regime, but also the U.S. empire.
Let's talk more about that, because some of the headlines, I appreciate so much how little you've slept, if at all, and all the interviews you're doing. So I have been looking at the headlines. I haven't been quite as busy as you. And many of the headlines in the New York Times, the Washington Post, generally the pro-Washington media or the U.S. regime media, is that Iran is isolated, that there has been quote-unquote global condemnation of Iran. And then when you click, you know, you click under the headline, global means the usual suspects, the U.S., France, Germany, Britain, so on. But talk to us about
the community, yes, which consists of these countries.
Yeah, exactly. But talk to us about what the world looks like from the perspective of the government. I know that you're not here as a government spokesperson, but you're an informed analyst. But what is the world that the government in Tehran sees in terms of the immediate neighbors? What conversations will they be having with some of those U.S. allied Gulf regimes, for example, with the broader international community, whether it's Russia, China, India, or other powers in the region, Turkey, for example, which reportedly closed its airspace to any retaliation against Iran? So what does the world look like from Iran in terms of reaction to this and what Iran will be saying to those countries?
Well, first of all, I think it shows the limits of American power in our region. You recall that before the Iranians carried out the attack, they informed the countries of the region what was about to happen. And especially since Iran was going to use lots of drones, and the drones travel slowly across Iraq and Syria. Then there are the missiles that come afterwards. They will be going over Iraqi airspace and a neighboring country. So the Iranians have to inform different countries what they're going to do. But in the case of the countries in the Persian Gulf that have American bases, the Iranians sent a very harsh warning. They said that, look, if the American air bases or the American bases in your country are used against us, that means you are standing against us and you will face the consequences, which I think is a very reasonable position to take. But in any case, the point here is that the Americans did not use those bases. And so these countries or these family dictatorships or regimes or whatever we'd like to call them, they recognize the limitations of American power now. The Americans know that if the Iranians really launch a heavy missile and drone strike, especially in the Persian Gulf region, that it will be devastating because, first of all, there are so many installations that are vulnerable out there. Second of all, they're minutes away. They're not, you know, in the case of Israel, it has to go all the way across Iraq, Syria, or Jordan, and then strike targets inside occupied Palestine. So the benefits for these family dictatorships to have these military bases in their country have been shown to be very limited. On the other hand, the Iranian armed forces and the government, the administration, they've shown to the Iranian public that the Americans do not want conflict, because there's this lingering question in the minds of many people, are the Americans going to attack? But the Iranians have shown that the Americans don't want to attack because they know what will happen. So that is good for that's actually good for the Iranian markets. Over the past 10 days, people have been worried about what's going to happen, and it had an impact on the dollar and the Iranian rial. But I think that now people are looking and saying, well, so despite the fact that we directly struck targets inside the Israeli regime, the United States is not even contemplating taking part in any counterstrike. Of course, it's not really a counterstrike. What Iran did was the counterstrike because the Israelis carried out the aggression. But in any case, it just shows the limits of American power. So for Iran, it creates more confidence for ordinary people in the country. B, it shows regimes in the region that their reliance on the U.S. for their family dictatorships is not necessarily a very smart thing to continue doing. And also, as I said, it makes life more difficult for Israel because the Israelis have regularly targeted Hezbollah or Iran or Syrians or others, or those affiliated to Iran and Syria and Lebanon. But in future, they're going to have to be more careful. And so these groups, these people, these bodies inside Lebanon and Syria will be able to carry out and fulfill their jobs much more easily than before. And the hands of the Israeli regime are tied. Mm.
Dr. Morandi, I was wondering if you could talk about you might not have been able to see the video that we played just before you came on, but it was of Palestinians in Gaza watching the missiles sent from Iran into the entity. Just on a basic, like, human solidarity level, what does it mean for the people in Iran to be able to fight back against the genocidal regime in Israel and to show up for Palestinians 6 months into this genocide?
It's very important. And Iran has always been very sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. But I think that over the last 6 months, things have shifted dramatically. I have relatives who in the past, close relatives, who in the past would say, we have to strike a deal with Israel and there must be some sort of two-state solution and that sort of thing. Whereas now they're saying, we cannot deal with this regime. It has to go. These are like people who are not necessarily very pro-government or pro-administration or supportive of many of the policies that the Islamic Republic of Iran is currently pursuing. But many of them have been convinced that the Iranian argument all along was valid because the Israeli regime has exposed itself to be so barbaric. And there's a lot of anti-Arab propaganda in Iran and anti-Palestinian propaganda. There's a huge number of Persian media that's based in the West. Some of its official media like VOA Persian, BBC Persian, Deutsche Welle Persian, and so on. And a lot of them are funded by the State Department, the CIA, European governments. One nasty outlet is Iran International. There are Telegram channels. There are literally thousands of Iranians that are employed in these media outlets that are hostile towards Iran. But one of the elements of their anti-Iranian propaganda is many of them they're very hostile towards like Russia. They're hostile towards anything that the political establishment in the West is against. So if ties between Iran and Russia improve, they attack it. If Iran and China have some joint project, they attack it. If they attack religion. But interestingly, they are very hostile towards Arabs. And they're often explicitly racist. And they're often telling Iranians that the Arabs are your enemy. They're your natural enemy. And of course, we see a lot of that in the Arabic media too, which is funded by governments and so on against Iranians and Shias. And there's a lot of misinformation about Iran day and night, especially over the past couple of decades. But we are constantly being told that the Palestinians in particular hate Iranians. And in particular, they hate Shias. So, and this is something that ordinary people in Iran have heard, even those who don't watch these media outlets or don't follow them, because it's repeated by people in society, often people, begin to believe this sort of thing. So despite the fact that Western governments and their allies are constantly promoting anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian narratives for their Iranian audiences, there is a huge amount of support for the Palestinians. There's always been strong support, but now it's overwhelming, and I think it's probably the same across the board. We see, despite the Western media and what I've experienced over the last 24 hours with the Western media, despite their full support for the Israeli regime and everything and all the crimes that it commits, but we see so many young people in the West and people from all walks of life, as I said before, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, everyone, people fighting for the Palestinian people. So this is not unique to Iran. But we've seen a lot of clips online where people in Iran are passing around scenes of Palestinians cheering the missiles and so on. So the Iranians are, pass this around to one another to show that the Palestinian people are also celebrating the Iranian strike. So I feel some of the clips are actually quite moving. And the responses of the Iranians, some Iranians were on the street till morning celebrating, quite a few in different cities and in Tehran. I was not celebrating. I was busy doing media and it was very, very tiring and quite, frustrating at times, especially when dealing with the Western media. But I did see between interviews clips and things like that.
Yeah,
I did see a very touching clip of an Iranian worker. He'd been obviously working the night shift, I think doing maintenance a janitor or a street cleaner, and someone offered him a suite and said Iran just carried out this attack on Israel, and he was very thankful. He praised God and he thanked God. So that was also a very touching clip of an Iranian responding, and I've seen many others. And what I can certainly share or confirm that the Arab media, when I say the Arab, I'm generalizing, specific channels and specific trends do constantly try to incite hatred and fear of Iran and of Iranians and of Shia Islam. And I would say that has succeeded to some extent, but I think it's failed to a far greater extent, as we could see from the popular reaction, not just across Palestine, but across the region and in Jordan. If you take, for example, the contrast between the popular reaction and the government reaction, I mean, the government was restrained in what it said in terms of saying, we're defending Jordan's airspace, but literally no one in Jordan thinks Jordan was under attack. I mean, the only danger to Jordanians came from the projectiles which were shot out of the sky. Luckily, there were no injuries, but that would have been the greatest danger. And had they been allowed to continue on their way, that danger would have been completely eliminated and Jordan wouldn't have to worry about them. In any case, that said, just we've taken up much of your valuable time and you have been working so hard all night. So just a final question for you, Dr. Marandi, and we would, of course, be honored to spend more time with you, but we don't want to take too much. But a final question. The American television screens since last night and this morning of pro-regime media in the United States have been platforming all sorts of neocons and warmongers calling for the United States to carry out direct punitive strikes on Iran to deter Iran and really trying to augment and foment war. Is this something that you worry about, that Iranians worry about? There are, as we've talked about, the U.S. administration says it's not looking for that war, but there are forces in the United States, the hardliners here, we don't really have reformists. We only have hardliners in the United States. I know the cliche about Iran is that it's reformists versus hardliners. In the U.S., it's only hardliners. But the hardest of hardliners are really calling for outright war. Is this something that that the government and people in Iran will be worrying about?
No, I don't think so. During the last 10 days, we haven't seen the sort of scenes that we've seen in Israel and in Iran, of people going to shops and buying things and emptying shelves and that sort of thing. It's been business as usual. When Iran was much weaker, and I think Iran was most vulnerable in the 1990s, and also after the United States invaded both Iraq and Kuwait and Afghanistan, Iran was effectively surrounded and isolated, and the United States was the lone superpower, or as the hyperpower, as someone once called it. Back then, the United States never attacked Iran because Iran was too big and too powerful and too determined to defend itself. And the political culture in Iran and the religious culture in Iran made Iran a serious threat in case of any American attack against the country. A war against Iran, of course, would have been devastating for Iran, but the Americans wouldn't have been able to win. Otherwise, they would have invaded Iran. But now Iran is much more powerful. Iran is, militarily speaking, it's I think by far the most powerful country in West Asia, and it has allies across the region, powerful allies. Americans have not been able to stop Ansarullah's missiles. How are they going to stop Iranian missiles? In addition to that, Iran's isolation has been broken. Russia being sanctioned needs Iran much more than before. The Chinese are moving closer to Iran. Countries across the world are moving away from the U.S. camp as the West declines. And so Iran's isolation is collapsing, the isolation of Iran, and the sanctions, their impact is gradually decreasing and will decrease in the years ahead. But militarily speaking, Iran is, I think, they can defeat the United States. They can bring down the global economy. So there is a balance of terror, simply because, if for no other reason, because of so much of the oil and gas that the world consumes comes from the Persian Gulf and the Caucasus. So Americans know that. And that is
for
why
Pacifica
I don't
Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Israeli forces ramped up attacks across the Gaza Strip, killing 56 Palestinians and wounding another 89 in attacks, including on a market in the Maghazi refugee camp over the last 24 hours. Among the dead are children, bringing the death toll to 33,899, according to Gaza's health ministry. The death toll could rise as people are still trying to access victims under the rubble. Israel blames civilian casualties on Hamas, saying its militants fight in dense urban neighborhoods. Meanwhile, Qatar's prime minister today said negotiations for peace talks and hostage swap are stumbling between Israel and Hamas. Google workers held sit-ins and protests at offices in New York, Seattle, and Sunnyvale, California, to demand the company drop its $1.2 billion cloud computing contract with the Israeli military, Project Nimbus, saying it's being used to kill civilians in Gaza. Dozens sat in at the CEO of Google Cloud's office. Protesters read a statement from a Palestinian-American Google employee named Zaid.
I'm deeply distressed about Google providing technology to the Israeli government, including Google Images, which is used for target identification, with most targets ending up being civilians, according to confessions by IDF staff. I wish Google would do the right thing and pull out of Project Nimbus and restrict the use of Google technologies by the Israeli government now that we know that they are being used to kill civilians.
At least 9 were arrested by company orders, according to organizers. Google did not respond to Pacifica's request for a comment. Iran's president is warning the tiniest invasion by Israel would bring a massive and harsh response as the region braces for potential Israeli retaliation after Iran's attack over the weekend. This comes as British Foreign Secretary David Cameron said Israel is making a decision to act in response. Meanwhile, the U.S. and European Union are reportedly considering sanctions on Iran for those strikes. Russian strikes hit Ukraine north of Kiev, killing at least 14 people and wounding some 60 others, including children. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky pointed to Western allies and said the strike would not have happened if Ukraine had received enough air defense equipment and if the world's determination to counter Russian terror was also sufficient. The first 7 jurors for Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial were chosen after lawyers grilled members of the jury pool Tuesday about their social media posts, political views, and personal lives. The questioning was designed to help decide whether they could sit in fair judgment of the former president, who faces some 30 charges related to payments made to an adult film star who alleged an affair during Trump's 2016 presidential campaign that went unreported. The panelists selected include an information technology worker, an English teacher, an oncology nurse, a sales professional, a software engineer, and 2 lawyers. 11 more still need to be picked. The Supreme Court is considering a case that could upend convictions and prosecutions for the January 6th insurrection at the nation's capital in 2021. A Pennsylvania man convicted of obstruction of a congressional proceeding is challenging the obstruction law. If he wins, it could overturn obstruction convictions and guilty pleas for hundreds charged, including 2 of the charges in Trump's criminal election subversion case. Christopher Martinez reports.
Lawyer Jeffrey Green argued the case for the petitioner, former Pennsylvania police officer.
There are a host of felony and misdemeanor crimes that cover the alleged conduct. A Sarbanes-Oxley-based, Enron-driven, evidence-tampering statute is not one of them.
The law in question is part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, passed 20 years ago in the wake of the Enron accounting scandal. It makes it a crime to destroy or conceal documents used in an official proceeding. U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Preligar argued the case for the United States, saying that the petitioner is asking the court to impose a limit on the statute.
The fundamental wrong committed by many of the rioters, including petitioner, was a deliberate attempt to stop the joint session of Congress from certifying the results of the election. That is, they obstructed Congress's work in that official proceeding.
More than 1,350 defendants have been charged with January 6th related crimes.